what is the ratio of external debt to the natural capital? That will be the ratio which will give us the real signal about the sustainability of the economy from nature side.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. How does rising external debt affect natural capital? A new paper focuses on three river basins that are vital to the livelihoods and biodiversity of the countries that surround them. And it suggests ways that we can both measure and conserve that natural capital in the face of the economic forces that threaten it. Pushpam Kumar of the UN Environment Programme is the author. He joins me now. Pushpam, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Dean.
Pushpam, you're focusing on three river basins, as I mentioned in the introduction, the Mekong, Congo, and the Amazon. We're familiar with the names, but can you describe them?
These are three iconic river basins. River basin is a geomorphological unit, and it combines the river, forest, the riparian zone between the landmass and the river, and they provide a range of services and benefits to society and the people. They provide habitat to the biodiversity. They store carbon. For example, Congo River Basin, they store carbon, which is equivalent to one-third of the emission by a country called France. They provide the source and basis of livelihood to the people through water, nutrient cycling, timber, fees, recreation, trade. The kind of services they provide are precious, not only to the countries who are in their vicinity, but also to the rest of the world. And their role becomes more critical because they are under threat from urbanization, from agricultural expansion, from climate change and deforestation.
But there is a problem for many of these 21 countries that span the river basins. That is debt distress that they are either in or close to at the moment. If we measure strictly debt to GDP, what do we know about the sustainability of the debts of these countries and the impact on their growth?
Before we come to this question, I would like to explain that where is the need to link the natural resources or natural assets or natural capital of these three river basins with the external debt.
Mm-hmm.
In all these three river basins, our estimates show that the natural capital is showing a declining trend. If you start from 1992 until 2019, the period for which we have the statistics and the data, natural capital, basically the forest, fishes stock, hydrological flow, nutrients, biodiversity, that is showing a declining trend. And then you have trade, you have economic activities, fiscal and monetary policies, and people don't see the link between these economic phenomena and variables and biophysical happenings, that is the change in the natural capital. The idea is to bring economy and environment together so that inbuilt mechanism of economic science can take care of the degradation and depletion of natural capital. In theory, it is possible. Empirically, there are enough examples that wherever integration or the linking of the two sides have happened, we have got desirable result. Now, with that in mind, we move that, okay, natural capital are the main assets in these three river basins. The other could be produced capital, for example, building or machine. Third could be human capital. Produced and manufactured capital, along with human capital, they are transacted in the market. So you can see who is buying, who is selling, what is the exchange price, what is the transaction price. Sadly, except few attributes of natural capital like biomass or logwood or feedstock, other natural assets are not transacted in the market. Although they perform exactly all the functions the way produced or human capital does. But since there is either not well-functioning market or the market is missing altogether, the natural capital you can't see. So unnecessarily or out of proportion, the burden goes on natural capital to repay the debt of the country. For example, some country can choose to overfish and sell it to the market to earn the revenue and pay the debt, or at least interest on the debt. Similarly, one can cut the forest, sell the logwood, and earn the profit to pay the interest rate or the service charge on the external debt. So, ballooning external debt in this 3D river basins, they are compelling the decision makers and the national leaders to destroy or harvest natural capital unsustainably. This is adversely impacting the same people for which we are borrowing the money as external debt.
Let's take a break. We'll be back in a moment.
Throughout West Africa, women leaders are driving meaningful change.
You have to think about the way the country looks at its women and how it views its girls.
Hear their stories in the podcast, Women Leading Change, brought to you by the Sahel and West Africa Club at the OECD.
We've neglected our indigenous foods, which were historically very healthy.
I'm your host, Dr. Lena Coney-Hoffman. Tune in and be inspired as we explore the connections between gender and climate change, food systems, conflict, and urban expansion.
Women have risen to protect their children, to protect their families, to protect communities in the face of real terrorism.
So in this paper, you are advocating looking at debt analysis in a different way, modernizing it by going beyond GDP. Is the reason to do this, is it to bring in these missing markets?
There is a growing emphasis by global leaders that this GDP is good, but it does not capture all the transactions happening in the economy. So we need to move beyond GDP. Now, GDP has its problem, and we all know, and I'm sure the listeners know about it, that a large number of transactions are not captured by GDP. It does many good things, but it has its limitations, and economic science in the last 50 years has been very vocal about it. GDP does not do a lot of things which are required in the economy, and one of them is measuring sustainability. And by the way, it was never the purpose of GDP to measure well-being.
No.
So the emphasis is how to move beyond GDP. GDP is a flow concept. It is not a stock concept. So why not to measure change in the stock? That is all kind of capitals. That we do in UNEP, the Inclusive Wealth Report, basically measuring all kind of wealth. And that is what for UK, the report by Sir Parthadas Gupta in 2021 is strongly recommended. We must measure the change in the inclusive wealth per capita. And that has a strong correlation with the human welfare and human well-being, not GDP. But how to bring this natural capital, produced capital, and human capital, wealth statistics into real business? The real business is that how the fiscal design, instruments, monetary policies, trade policies, they recognize change in the wealth, not only GDP. Typically, we measure the ratio of external debt to GDP. And the idea of this ratio is that, okay, what is the solvency of the country to pay the debt? But if we really want to think about sustainability, if we really want to care about future generations, then it is better to see what is the ratio of external debt to the natural capital. Because that will be the ratio which will give us the real signal about the sustainability of the economy from nature side. We all are embedded in nature, all our activities directly or indirectly depend upon the services coming from natural capital. That's why having a ratio as external debt divided by natural capital will tell us where we stand in terms of our solvency. Hey, debt GDP is fine, but the real sustainability will come from debt natural capital or debt inclusive wealth ratio.
How do you manage to compute a value for natural capital? GDP statistics have a large infrastructure set up to measure them, but natural capital and a change in natural capital, that's much harder to measure.
Exactly, Tim. Believe me, we face this question all the time. The history of GDP is not very old, but it has a tradition. You have the input-output tables, and from that table, we derive GDP. I think the natural capital or inclusive wealth needs more granular data and, of course, the pricing for each attributes of capitals, which is not easy. But believe me, statistical work is never easy and a beginning has to be made. The question is not whether it is hard to estimate or easy to estimate. I agree with you that it requires a lot of data and a lot of capacity. You know, being a practitioner, I would say when I go to the countries and many countries, many countries in Africa, in Asia, in Amazonia, I find the capacity to do estimation is very, very basic. So a lot of emphasis has to go on capacity development. But then we have no choice. Otherwise, we will keep cutting the forest, we will keep depleting the fish stock, we will keep polluting the atmosphere, we keep polluting the soil, we keep throwing plastics in the ocean, we keep dumping chemicals in atmosphere, and we will keep thinking we are doing good because we have GDP growth rates, but it is not. It is not measuring human well-being at all. Even if it is a tough job, a beginning has to be made. There has been a huge interest from the governments of the world. If you compare with the past, at any point of time, that kind of interest has never been there. So I think interest is there, motivation is there. So we have to do it. We don't have any choice.
In the paper, interestingly, you measure the debt ratios and the economic sustainability of these river basins. But as you point out, they span many countries. GDP is measured on a country-by-country basis. Nature doesn't know that there are national borders. How do you go about calculating the aggregate debt, the natural capital, the economic output of a river basin?
External debt is not calculated by the unit called river basin. It follows the unit, which is the nation or the county or the provinces. Easily accessible data on debt is at the national level, which you get from IMF or even from the World Bank, and the National Statistical Office of each country keep the record. But natural capital transcends the boundary. However, in order to make it comparable ratio, we have estimated natural capital for each country and also external debt and also the domestic debt, both. In fact, in the paper, we have used both internal and external debt. If we are estimating this ratio for DRC Congo or Gabon or Ecuador or PDR Laos, it will be for that particular country. What is interesting, if you compare the GDP ratio and the debt, natural capital or wealth ratio, in last 30 years, there has been a sharp rise in the debt to natural capital ratio. We are becoming more and more unsustainable. It may be the case that by having external debt, we have been able to build more buildings. Maybe we have been able to plant some factories. But then we are assuming here that by building this manufactured capital, we can substitute natural capital, which we have destroyed in each of the countries. But substitutability has a problem. One type of capital cannot be substituted for other infinitely. Even for next 30, 40 years, it is not going to happen. And The real challenge is that in our lifetime, we are seeing the problem which was never experienced 50 years back. You see climate change. You see the loss of biodiversity. 1 million species are under risk of extinction every year. 7% of the GDP is lost due to air pollution, PM2.5 alone. And by 2030, we will have more plastic in the ocean than fish. So the idea is to do a good economics, a sane economics, and one of the sane approaches is have a better debt natural capital ratio so that decision makers can get a real signal whether their economy is moving in the right direction, and the right direction is sustainable direction or not.
What you're finding out from this analysis is that in the attempt to manage that debt-GDP ratio, then the countries affected around those river basins are eroding their natural capital. So even if they manage to keep the debt-GDP ratio more or less the same, or at least try and manage it, then the natural capital is being eroded faster. So that ratio is going down.
That is exactly the point, that many countries in these river basins are eroding the natural capital and treating them as growth or improvement in their income. They are also mixing income with wealth, destroying the wealth and treating proceedings coming from the wealth destruction as the income. And if we remember Simon Kuznets, the great economist, he said mixing income with wealth is a very bad economics. Then also, some countries are destroying natural capital and improving human capital. And this is very natural that you cut the forest, sell the logwood, make schools and colleges and hospitals. But then there is a trade-off, and decision makers must recognize that you are going up on human capital, for example, but then your forest is gone, your carbon sink is gone, and you have destroyed your biodiversity. And all these three things which I just mentioned, they are equally important for people, their well-being, their welfare, even for their production, consumption, and distribution. They derive the source and material from natural capital, and that must not be forgotten.
So it's very important to be able to measure these ratios. But of course, that raises the question, what can we do about them? Now, you argue in favor of debt for nature swaps as policy. What are these?
When the countries are overburdened with debt, they have no choice, by the way, but to cut the forest or extract natural capital and sell it to pay the debt. Of course, there has been a lot of noises, and right noises, either waive the loan, if that is not going to happen, reduce the interest rate, or make the duration longer so that we have some resource which we can spare and divert it to the more pressing issues, for example, climate change or any investment for adaptation or mitigation. These countries have no money. I'm not saying all the countries in these three river basins, but mostly LMICs, countries whose income is from $1,200 to $12,000, they have the same story, that they don't have money to invest in intervention to combat climate change or loss of biodiversity. Debt for nature swap is basically if you spend on biodiversity improvement or climate change mitigation adaptation activities, then some of the loan can be waived or reduced. Or the third parties come, like some international conservation organizations, and they purchase the loan given to the developing country from the developed country, for example. And then they say, look, guys, $50 million is your debt. So they say, I pay this money to the developed country. Now you have to conserve your biodiversity, and I'm here to take charge of your loan. So you can pay me in the long run, or maybe sometimes the loan can be waived altogether. Now, as you can see that in debt for nature or debt for climate swap business, three agencies are involved. The country which has given the loan, the country which has received the loan, and one intermediary organization. It could be conservation organization, it could be financial institution, some civil society, some global NGOs, the case varies. And I think there has been some very good result. There are some success stories in Africa, in Asia, in Amazonia, where the debt has played a big role in managing natural capital in an unfavorable direction. If the debt to natural capital ratio is brought prominently in the estimation, then it will be very easy baseline for these all three institutions to implement debt for nature swap. We had last year in October, November, a conference of parties of biodiversity, CBD, in Cali, Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 or 7 conservation organizations, they have come out with some money and they are going to the countries who are burdened with external debt, but who are naturally source-rich countries or natural capital-rich countries, that, hey guys, how can we help you? And in fact, what the governments could not do, these NGOs are doing, and they have given very good results. Today, 45% of middle-income countries are debt-stressed. And unfortunately or fortunately, these countries also have precious biodiversity. They are the ones who are also facing the wrath of climate change and pollution. So I think if these two sides can be brought together, it will be easier to implement debt for nature or debt for climate swap. The first debt for nature swap came in 1984, if I'm not wrong. And since then, off and on, there are some examples which keep coming. But why not so many countries going for it? You need a lot of trust. You need a lot of institutions,
yes,
to bring all the parties on the table and create a trust so that you are going to waive my loan and you have trust in me that, okay, I'm going to do the thing which is really needed. There are some enabling conditions which we need, but I think the first and foremost is to have a concrete and credible ratio between debt and natural capital. And that is where this paper is trying to drive the point.
I mentioned earlier the practical difficulties in measuring natural capital, the changes in natural capital, but I'm also interested in how a debt for nature swap could be implemented domestically. Imagine I'm a farmer in Amazonia. I am paid with money to produce whatever I am farming. How am I then compensated if there is now an incentive to protect nature?
That's a very, very good question, Tim. Whenever the issue comes of ecosystems or natural capital, you have to identify who are the beneficiaries and who are the providers in clear-cut terms. And secondly, this issue also goes in the domain called payment for ecosystem services or compensation for ecosystem damages. So we must identify that what is the incremental ecosystem services or incremental natural capital and who is responsible for this incremental service or incremental capital, and the providers and the beneficiaries, this would also have the trust. And that is where a role of government becomes very important, whether within the country or across the country. I think if trust is not there, institutions are absent, or institutions are not well functioning, I think it will have difficulty in implementing what you have just pointed out. But as an economist, our job should be to provide a credible and socially relevant estimates of incremental ecosystem services, incremental natural capital, and clear-cut identification of who are the beneficiaries and who are the providers. I think people who have been following this discussion would know something called bioprospecting. When we discuss about biodiversity, you know, it has been there for the last 50, 40 years. Sometimes it comes up and people get excited about it, that it looks, if there is a benefit, between the pharmaceutical firms and the local people or indigenous people who know about the biodiversity, then the benefit sharing is not happening. Just to make it more clear. So you are pharmaceutical firm. I am a local person. I know what kind of biodiversity or plant species can give you the phytochemicals for new drug discovery. You are a pharmaceutical firm. You are looking for the lead or the clue for the new drug. And we know that combinatorial chemistry in the lab has its limitations. So in order to have new drug, you have to go back to the nature. Either you go to the land-based biodiversity or you explore marine biodiversity. So that is where you get the new chemicals or lead or phytochemicals for your new drug. Now, if locals are the custodian of the biodiversity, what benefit they will get out of it? I think since 1992, the CBD says that the locals are the custodian of the biodiversity. But there are plenty of examples. I won't name the companies, but they are known all over the world, that they extracted phytochemicals and developed new drug, earned billions, not million, billions, but the local didn't get a single penny. But now, under the CBD access and benefit sharing, the benefits of this endeavor must be shared between the local and the pharmaceutical firm. If there is concrete estimation of the benefits, that how much benefits are being generated, and if locals are made as the part of this venture, which can be based to the net revenue or the gross revenue, depends, then we can have a credible access and benefit sharing, which is a real bone of contention in this business. But that also brings the issues how we distribute the benefits of biodiversity. It should be exploited, it should be harvested, it should be conserved, and at the same time, it can also improve the life and livelihood of the people, and many of them are poor people in the biodiversity-rich areas of the world.
Finally, Pushpan, whatever the weight of your argument, it is far from the political mainstream in many creditor countries. Can we possibly make debt for nature swaps a feasible tool? What happens if we don't?
All the economic instruments, they are tools, they are advisory services to the politically elected or non-politically elected leaders. As an economist, our role is to provide a range of options and provide them the compelling reason that what is at stake if they don't use it, or how this instrument can help them better. Whether it is debt, GDP ratio, estimating natural capital and inclusive wealth and moving beyond GDP, debt for nature swap, access and benefit sharing mechanism between the local and the pharmaceutical firms, they all provide a very structured, credible, scientific basis to the problems which we are facing in the domain of climate change and biodiversity. There are plenty of papers, Tim, showing how these instruments can provide net gain to society. One can see which group is benefited more and less, but nonetheless, they are welfare-improving instruments. That is what we have to tell to the decision makers and the political masters. That is the reason that right now a range of tools and approaches are being used in trade, in fiscal policy, in monetary policy, in how we use sovereign wealth funds, how we do accounting. It takes time. It takes time. Sometimes it could be frustrating, but we have to play our role.
Pushpan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dame.
Now look out for this paper. It is called The Impact of Growing Debts on Natural Capital, Evidence from Amazon, Congo and Mekong River Basins. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the topics we feature. And if you like what you're hearing, remember, leave us a review and tell someone else about us.